Monday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast, getting to part two of our Reddit mailbag. Our sponsors today are MeUndies. Go ahead and revamp your underwear drawer. Go to MeUndies.com/capspace to get 20% off your first pair. And then SeatGeek. Use that capspace code to get a $20 rebate off of your first SeatGeek purchase. All right, so why don't we continue on here with these other two questions from Drop That Durka Dirk. I thought both of these were pretty good.
The first one of the remaining ones is, if the Jazz look to move Derek Favors this summer, what do you think would be a fair return?
And he suggested something like a lottery-protected future first. Favors is an interesting case. If he had had a healthy year this year, he's got 1 year, about $11 million left on his contract after this. You could look at him and say, hey, George Hill got the number 12 pick. Thad Young got the 20th pick, and then also that reverse protected second rounder that has to be in the top half of the second round. Favors is better than either of those guys. He should get more than that. Those guys both, and yeah, I guess Young too also had 2 years left on his contract rather than the one for Hill. But those are some analogs. However, Favors has not been healthy, number one. Number two, year by year, combo bigs like him become less valued. Now, he's in a different case because he's a good defender. I think he's a solid, especially before he got hurt, he was a good defender at power forward. Even his ability to get out on players was impressive. Him and Gobert together has been very good defensively. Whether he can hold up as a center, you know, he's kind of more of a Tristan Thompson type of center in some ways now. Maybe a little better rim protector than Tristan, but not much, but a guy who can move his feet. But that's if he's healthy, and we don't know where he's at with all these knee problems he's had the last couple of years. So I do think maybe a lottery protected future first seems about right to me. But, you know, was it like, do the Jazz want to go into next season with Boris Diaw, though I think Diaw actually is a free agent. Joe Johnson.
He has a non-guarantee.
Oh, and he's another non-guarantee still?
Oh, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that was this year.
I thought this was the last year of that. Haha, I beat you to it. He does, in fact, have another non-guaranteed season at $7.5 million next year.
That'll be interesting.
And a late guarantee date of July 15th. So they can, they're probably not going to be using cap space anyway this summer as long as Hill comes back. I mean, as we talked about, there's a lot of concerns there. So I think, because what if Gordon Hayward leaves in free agency, right? Like then they just need more talent on the roster at that point. They got to keep him around. And again, we've talked about how in the NBA, it's so hard to trade like for like in terms of talent, even if from one position to another. So I think that seems like about right value, but I don't think it's quite as obvious that he's going to get traded. If everyone comes back and you know, then maybe they would look to move him. But and then a lot of it depends too on how well they play in the playoffs. Like what if he comes back and plays pretty well in the playoffs and we decide, hey, this formula can actually work with him. But if they did look to move him, that seems like about right value for me.
Favors will turn 26 this summer. And depending on how serious you think his injuries are, he might even be kind of an older 26. He did come into the NBA pretty young and a talented guy. But as you said, the league is kind of moving past him a little bit. That seems like a fair return. But I also don't think that's necessarily what the Jazz are looking for, considering they're competitive right now.
Right.
They might look for a similar value, but in a very different form. I don't know exactly who that would be, but
and keep in mind, they got two draft picks this year. And then they have a protected first coming still, lottery protected first coming from OKC that could convey as soon as next summer as well.
Yeah. So they don't exactly need more. I mean, it's not saying they would turn it down if that were the way it was going to go. And also Favors not only has value because of his cheap contract next year, but also he has a low cap hold for the year after. So depending on where that team's structure is, but my instinct is that he will not be traded this summer. However, it's entirely possible to me that he gets moved at some point during next season, and he could actually be a very interesting one where I could see him moving before the deadline, like substantially before the deadline, if the Jazz kind of realize that he doesn't fit with what they are, but that's not because of his value. Like let's say he's been healthy for a month and he's been fine, but they realize they want to go in a different direction. Let's say Hayward comes back, then maybe they move him before he gets hurt again or before anything like that. That would be a very interesting proactive move that they should consider.
Yeah, and Favors, he's a really good player. Like, when healthy, and it's been a shame.
Well, I mean, there was that discussion. Remember, a year ago at this time, we were discussing who the best player on the Jazz was, and he was involved in that conversation.
Oh, absolutely. And obviously, Hayward and Gobert have both made big strides this year to really even outstrip where he was last year. But I think that if he could get back to that level that he was 2 years ago, which is not impossible, as you said, he's 26, that, again, I don't know what player they could get that would give them the upside that he necessarily would. And it also just makes them a really tough matchup. Also, there's not a ton of spacing, but he also will just, if you put a power forward on him, you just destroy that guy in the post. So, and those two guys are also awesome defensively together. One other note on his value, the Jazz cannot extend him. Nobody who is acquiring him can give him an extension that he would take, because the most they could offer him would be 120% of his $11 million salary to start with. He would not take that offer. But a team that acquired him that had cap space could renegotiate and extend him. We talked about the Jazz doing that. That ship has probably sailed now, unless George Hill leaves. But another team could look to do that with him still. Last question here. On the last 15 and 60, we talked about how the Heat have turned around their season offensively. They've been a top 5-7 defense this year. I'm wondering what you think the keys have been to their defensive success.
There are a lot of different components with them. One of them, the biggest ones, is effort. Like, this team just, they go at it hard, and they also play
effort,
a lot of different
effort and
guys.
Conditioning. Yeah, yes. I think, because you can try really hard, but then if you get tired, you can't try hard anymore. So conditioning is huge.
An underrated element that I think is a part of their story and a few other teams, and we saw this actually with Deion Waiters in the playoffs last year, is strength is a very important consideration if you can get it while still maintaining reasonable athleticism. And Miami happens to have a lot of strong guys for their position.
Yeah, James Johnson among those. I mean, he and Waiters have both played very well. But it is an interesting point, because if you look at their starting lineup, Luke Babbitt is not a great defensive player. Whiteside still is a big presence at the rim, and I think when he's engaged, it's underrated how good he can be there. Now, in the pick and roll, he can be a liability, and his effort still will wax and wane, but they've gotten more out of him this year. I thought their defense at the start of the year was going to be awesome, but that's because I thought that the guys getting most of the minutes were going to be Josh Richardson, Tyler Johnson, and Justice Winslow, and those guys haven't played as much. Johnson still is pretty good. Richardson has played, and he's still a good defender. Rodney Magruder has been excellent for them. Also, Wayne Ellington is not viewed that way, but they've gotten decent performance out of him. I mean, it's just been Coach Spoelstra has done an amazing job, and I think that's the biggest thing that you can point to for that. What do we have next here?
From Cy_the_photo_guy, what teams outside of the playoffs, projected, I guess, because we don't know yet, have the best chance to make it in next season, and who falls out?
So I think we could start just by ruling out who's not the answer to this question. The Magic, the Nets, the Suns, the Lakers, and the Kings, I think, have almost no chance of being in the playoffs next year. Would you agree with that? I mean, obviously things can change, but
barring a sea change, yes.
Well, and not only am I saying that because those teams don't have a ton of talent on the roster, but I'm also saying that because all five of those teams, I wouldn't put the Nets in this category, but they don't have their draft pick or really a way to get better. But the Magic, Suns, Lakers, and Kings, all those teams have had inconsistent managerial performances, shall we say. So I don't necessarily trust those teams to make some awesome moves that are going to get them to improve. And that's when you consider the limited resources they have at their disposal to begin with. I mean, I guess the only way that you could see that changing is what if the Lakers just decide to try and make a trade with, if they keep their draft pick, then they try to make a trade and pick up like a Paul George or something like that. But again, that seems very unlikely to me. Who did you see? Was there anyone else that you ruled out other than those five?
No, I think there are teams like the Knicks that have an outside shot of it, but the Knicks could certainly be good enough to make the playoffs. Like, I'm not going to write them off at all. But to answer the question in terms of who has the best chance to make it next season, for me, it's the Minnesota Timberwolves. The Timberwolves have a ton of talent, and they also have a confluence of factors that a lot of the other teams that are just missing won't. One, they're young, so they'll improve that way. Two, they have cap space, so they'll improve in that way. And three, they don't have players that are on their team right now, other than Shabazz Muhammad, who are going to leave. So basically, all they're doing is adding. So they could trade guys away. They could trade Ricky Rubio. They could do a few other things. But I think that they're in that place that's different from Portland, who I think is another serious contender for this, where Portland, it's going to be hard for them to get better. They can get better just by being improving from where they were this year, but in terms of new talent, it's going to be hard.
It was between Wolves, Blazers, and Nuggets for me, but you could see the Nuggets potentially taking a step back if they lose Gallo and just aren't able to get it together on defense. You know, maybe they trade away Wilson Chandler and Fareed, and they just, I could see next year being a little bit more of a consolidation year for them, even as some of their young talent may look pretty good. They also, it's possible even that they could, have a coaching change as well at some point during the year if they disappoint. Like that wouldn't be impossible. I had picked the Blazers over the Wolves a little bit. They've been playing better since Nurkic came into the fold. I just think that Dame and CJ are really good. So they would be my pick, but I agree with you that if you wanted to say like which of those teams is most likely to really break out and get to like 50 wins, I would probably put the Wolves there. So pretty tough choice. And what about in the East? Who, if you had to just limit that answer solely to the East?
I would probably say whoever of the Heat, Bucks, and Pistons doesn't make the playoffs. So because all those teams, you have a reason to believe that they could make it the next year. The Pistons are going to bring back largely similar talent. The Heat have been super well coached and they have a lot of flexibility. And then if the Bucks don't make it, they're the obvious pick because I fully expect them to make it next year. So I would go with those guys. But actually, what I wanted to turn back on you was I actually struggled a lot with the second part of this question related to the West of who's going to fall out. And I ended up eventually settling on a hedge that I don't love, but I think is the most accurate answer of whoever gets hurt.
Oh, you're talking about next year?
Yeah, because all the teams in the West,
who replaces them? Yeah,
right. Like Oklahoma City, I think they've performed over their head in clutch games this year, but they should have good talent next year. I don't really have an issue with that. Memphis, that could be the year they fall off, but it also could be the year that they don't. I like some of the young guys that they brought in that haven't really had a chance to play this year. And then everybody above them, I mean, there's the chance, of course, that the Clippers just blow it up and that they fall out, but I'm not going to bet on that right now.
Yeah, they are playing pretty poorly, though, recently, even with all their guys healthy. The Jazz, if they lose Gordon Hayward, they could be in big trouble. But yeah, I think the Clippers, Thunder, Grizzlies, those teams, the Grizz, you know, could are going to be a year older, not a ton of talent in the pipeline, shall we say, for them. I mean, Chandler Parsons, if you had to bet on whether he's going to contribute positively next year or not, you would have to lean towards not. And then, yeah, there are these hungry teams, Blazers, Nuggets, Wolves, even the Mavs, you know, have played really 500 ball since that horrible injury riddled start. The Pels presumably are going to be better next year with Cousins and AD. If they could just get some three-point shooting around those guys, maybe Cousins could actually get in a little better shape. They might have a coach upgrade next year, depending on what happens with Gentry.
Oh, and a team in the East, because we didn't talk about East teams that could fall out. The Hawks, depending on what happens. I mean, I believe in Budenholzer as a coach, and I think he can lead a less talented team to the playoffs. But if they lose Millsap without a return.
Yeah, and Millsap's going to go downhill anyway. I mean, the East is interesting to me because I think right now it seems to me that the Celtics, Cavs, Wizards, and Raptors are the top tier. But that those teams also are looking like they're going to be the top tier for the foreseeable future if they retain their talent. I mean, the Hawks are on the way down. And the Heat, Pacers, Bucks, Bulls. If Jabari were still healthy and still playing at that same level, and they brought back Middleton, I would feel better about the Bucks' chances to move maybe into the top four in the East. But not many of these teams down there appear to have a lot of upward mobility. Maybe the Pacers if they fix their bench, or the Pistons if they just, you know, Reggie Jackson comes back and plays a little bit better. But I mean, it seems like the chance of any team in the East that's not already playing at that level getting to like a 50 win amount next year, like, doesn't look very good for
well
for
and the
sure.
Sixers have that potential long term, but crawl walk run, I mean, they're not going to be there next year.
Yeah, well, a lot of it I mean, they're gonna have $50 million in cap space, and they could
and Colangelo spending it, not, you know, so they might actually go after it.
Yeah, then I mean, if Embiid plays a whole year next year and they have Simmons back, I think they're just going to be too young. I agree with you with the crawl walk run, that I don't want to project that there. But yeah, I mean, I guess you could even would say if you wanted to pick of all the teams that are in the bottom 11 in the East right now, if you wanted to say which of those teams is most likely to win 50 games next year, I still might actually go with the Sixers out of all those teams, just because I think they would have the upside if they everyone gets healthy. And, you know, but they're going to have maybe one or two top 10 rookies, and like, it doesn't seem likely to me, but you know, they played so well with Embiid on the floor this year.
Joel Embiid's defensive rating this year was 99.1. If he can stay on the floor for 70 games, I think they could actually do it.
Okay, let's move on here. Contra positive, if you're Celtics GM and you get a top two pick, do you trade Isaiah Thomas either immediately or after he re-signs a max contract?
I think this is a false choice and a very important one in terms of laying out the Celtics situation. So if they draft a point guard, that player is not going to be good right away. The Celtics want to be competitive. So the ideal circumstance for Boston, I mean, I think the way that you play that, if they get, let's say they take Lonzo Ball or Markel Fultz, is you're going to need a while to evaluate it. Summer league, training camp, and then at least part of the actual season playing against NBA players. If in the best case scenario, that guy looks like the real deal and that they can contribute right away, then you can trade Isaiah Thomas at that point. Otherwise, unless a team makes a stupid offer for him, they have enough flexibility to just kind of wait it out a little bit longer, and then maybe they make a move at the deadline, maybe not. But I don't think that signing Thomas to a max contract, which would be next summer, that would be summer of 2018, yeah. I don't think he's a positive on that contract.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to answer this question in the assumption that, you know, Isaiah continues playing close to his regular season level in the playoffs, and that the Celtics don't disappoint in the playoffs, which to me would be either, you know, a hard fought second round loss, or they make it to the East Finals. In that case, moving Isaiah, once again, as we talked about, it's not really possible in the NBA to trade a superstar, which is what Thomas has been this year, to trade him and get pieces that are going to help you as much as he helped you immediately. So if they're a team that's looking to be in contention, a lot of it depends too on the offseason. What if they bring in Gordon Hayward, or they bring in another like pretty good free agent to where they reasonably feel like, hey, we're in contention. You know, we got to go for it this year. I mean, teams that project to be top four teams in a conference almost never trade players away. I mean, and remember, we talked about that with Paul Millsap, right? Like, he's in the last year of his contract. He's older than Isaiah. He's not as good as Isaiah. And the Hawks are nowhere near as good as the Celtics, and they still didn't trade him away, right? So this idea that they're going to trade him unless things just go so badly in the playoffs this year, or someone gets hurt, or they strike out in free agency and they get that top two pick. And the way that this trade would happen would be if they say, hey, you know what? It's clear. We're just not going to contend. We didn't get anyone in free agency. Let's just get what we can for Thomas. We got this pick. We got Jaylen Brown, these young guys. We really should be building now. Take a step back and let's try to be really awesome again in three or four years. But as long as they're in contention, I don't see that deal happening. And then, you know, whether he gets a max contract or not, I think you just have to let it play out and get more information. Because what if you draft Fultz or Ball and they get hurt their first year, or they just don't look like they're going to be that good? And then your team is still pretty good. And you're like, hey, you know what? Like, I get it. Isaiah's 29. He's undersized. But what else are we going to use this money on? We can't replace him because we're capped out anyway. Maybe Fultz and Ball or Ball might not be that good. So yeah, I think the chance of him being traded are very, very small to me. Anything else on that one, or should we do a commercial here?
Let's make some money.
Well, that was a rather clunky lead into the commercial, but fortunately, the product that we're recommending is pretty easy to sell. It's just the most comfortable underwear that I've ever owned. MeUndies. If you've been settling for these sorry store-bought underwear five packs, MeUndies is just far, far superior. It's designed in LA and made from sustainably sourced micromodal, a fabric that is three times softer than cotton. They come in an ever-changing selection of classic colors, bold shades, adventurous patterns that you can tailor to your own personal style. You can even save up to 33% each month with a monthly subscription. Basically, you're buying in bulk to save. But if you're not going to do a subscription, you can still save with 20% off your first pair at MeUndies.com/capspace. You can go ahead and revamp your underwear drawer. I had a buddy who started dating a girl, and she was less than complimentary of his underwear. And so he decided to utilize that MeUndies.com/capspace URL, revamp his underwear drawer, and now that's no longer an issue for him. So just give it a shot and check it out. That first pair with the 20% off is well worth your time. I think you'll find, as I did, that it's the most comfortable pair of underwear that you've owned. MeUndies.com/capspace is that URL. All right, you want to do a little lightning round here as we did last time? Just put the clock on 30 seconds and we'll just, each of us will answer on our own here.
So do you want to ask and answer it ourselves? Is that the way you want to do it this time?
I think it's more fun if we pick the other person's one, unless we just find one that we're desperate to answer. But
okay, from ESM18, do you think there are areas of draft prospect skill sets that traditional scouts and teams routinely overrate and or some they underrate?
Underrating, I think, is just, again, the ability to potentially be a 3-and-D player, to be a role player. You always want to see players who can score. It's interesting that usually the players who get drafted, or even if they're a senior and they're not going to project to that role in the NBA, they'll be averaging like 18 a game in college. So I think more role players in college in the D League, maybe that's undervalued a little bit. And then overvalued is just scoring. I think especially scoring in college in the mid-range when you're not really exploding all the way to the basket. Sorry if I went too long there.
That's okay. I just wanted to say, yeah, just ball handling in general for me. I think it's for non point guards, it's actually a little bit underrated. I think about Ben McLemore as an example of that. I wanted to mention that.
Yeah, and I'm blowing through the time limit here. But yeah, I agree. Shot creation among players who just are not going to be able to create their own shot in the NBA. I think Evan Turner is like the perfect example of that, him going number two when he just isn't able to create the kind of separation to have the athleticism you need to be a primary shot creator in the NBA. All right, let me find you one here. Track Auto asks, is the Stepien rule necessary anymore?
Yes. Look at the Nets. Look at the Kings. Yes.
I agree with you wholeheartedly there. It's just, and not only is it necessary because it prevents teams from giving away their draft pick, but it's also like just a reminder that it's a really stupid thing to do. That it's so stupid that there's a rule that prevents you from doing it.
From CWebFan23, what's up with the Bucks? Is this recent surge fueled by Middleton's return? Maybe Jabari's absence has actually helped them.
Well, having Middleton's probably a more effective player winning NBA games than Jabari is. But the recent thing is just they've gotten lucky in close games since the All-Star break, 9-5 with a negative net rating. So I think they're playing really right around the same level that they were playing. It's just they've gotten some good luck in close games lately. Here's one that should take 30 seconds. 50 Puff, what moves can Portland make? CJ's new salary kicks in next year and they don't have much cap room. That's probably actually understating their lack of flexibility.
Yeah, they're deep into the luxury tax, which means that even just clearing salary doesn't make them a team that can use cap space. So really what they can do is, most important thing is use their taxpayer mid-level exception well and try to find takers for some. If they can find people who are interested in somebody like Myers Leonard, that would be great. If not, they're pretty much going to have to roll it back and use that taxpayer MLE really well because they don't have many asset contracts on their books that they're willing to trade.
I'll take this one myself here. Azizinator25, what team do you personally think you'd do the best job coaching? The answer is no team. I would be infinitely worse than even the worst coach in the NBA. I might be able to help a little bit with some rotations and some late game strategy, but I have no idea how to run a practice. I don't know plays, although I'm trying to get better at that. And most importantly, my coaches would, or my players would, have absolutely zero respect for me because I've never coached before at any level.
I'll do one for myself too, since we've gone in that way once. From Why Not Dolphins, between the five teams vying for the last three spots in the East, so they classified that as the Pacers, Bucks, Heats, Pistons, and Bulls, which I think is fair, which has the best chance of pulling an upset in round one? I would say the Pacers. The Heat are definitely an option here as well, but the Pacers just have talent in a nice distribution. Paul George can really take it to another level. Miles Turner's become a better defensive five, and Jeff Teague can help run their offense. I think they can put a scare into a lot of teams. Miami has this wonderful set. We also don't know what's going on with Waiters, but since so much of what they do is based on depth and defense and effort, those things often wane a little bit when we get into the playoffs, but the Heat could certainly do it as well.
Yeah, Pacers and Heat for me, I see no chance for the other teams to pull much of an upset. Last one here, Retro Bro 90. This will be so short of an answer that you'll have time to answer it too. Whose draft stock do you expect to rise as the tourney progresses? I have no idea. I don't really watch the tournament. I think that in some ways you can actually improve your draft evaluation by not caring about what happens in the tournament compared to the regular season at all.
I agree with that, but I'll just say probably the Duke guys. just off assumption, I think they're going to go far in the tournament. And
yeah, yeah, whatever team does well, right? That's basically it.
Yeah. Oh, can I do one? Well, or do you want to start doing some longer questions? Because there are a few more that I want to answer.
Oh yeah, I mean if you've got some of these some quick hitters here, let's bang them out.
Okay, from D Hall of Fame. What do you think will happen with the Clippers this offseason, and what do you think should happen? So what I think will happen is actually less interesting. I think they're going to just run it back, which is that they're going to offer full maxes to Blake and to CP, and they're both going to come back. JJ Redick's a more interesting question. I could see him seeing the writing on the wall and going somewhere like Minnesota if they make a similar offer.
Well, and
the
Clippers I think he's going to find more money elsewhere.
Yeah. So I think that, and then that'll just lead to, I talked about this actually with Arturo Galletti on Real Jam Radio, with the Grizzlies, it being a team that will eventually age themselves into the wilderness. Like, I think that's what's going to happen with them. And so Doc will stick around until he thinks that there's not much he can do. What I think should happen is, I guess, actually pretty close to that. I advocated for them to trade Chris Paul and should a year and a half ago, and the reason for that was the writing on the wall at that point. But them tanking or losing all those guys at this point doesn't really create a better circumstance, because they still have all this money tied up in Jamal Crawford and Austin Rivers and DeAndre, though I think DeAndre's contract is very good.
Yeah, mostly agree there. What could change it is just if they lose in the first round in ugly fashion, which the way they've played lately, I wouldn't rule that out. Also, maybe another component here too is that Steve Ballmer is looking to find a new arena solution, and there's talk that he might try to join up with Stan Kroenke's project in Englewood with the Rams, and having a good team can't hurt with that, or at least even be, you know, if they're terrible, which if they let all these guys go, they would be for quite some time. You know, I don't think he's ready to face the music on that yet. All right, here's a longer one. Diabetics Puppy, who according to his avatar, do you say Avi or
Avatar? I say it like the, yeah, like the James Cameron movie.
Right, right. But when you abbreviate it, is it, you would use it like AVI is how you abbreviate that? Would you say that Avi or Avi? Avi probably, huh? Avi Avatar?
I don't know.
We're old. Yeah. How do you feel about Steph Curry winning the MVP race in large part because of the Warriors' wins in 2015, despite Harden's better season stats wise, now that Westbrook is favored by you guys this year, despite having less wins but slightly stronger stats? Well, that is a mischaracterization in a number of ways. One is that I don't think Harden did have better season stats than Curry.
He had better counting stats than Stephen Curry, yeah, but he played more minutes, and part of the reason he played more minutes was because Curry didn't play in fourth quarters because they didn't need him to.
Yeah, I think by the advanced metrics, they were pretty similar. And then also, if you want to, I think that result was pretty well backed up by the fact that Curry really dominated him head-to-head in the playoffs. I mean, you remember Harden's game five, he was 3-16 with 13 turnovers as they got beaten pretty badly, and Curry's game three in that series was pretty unbelievable, and the only reason that wasn't a sweep probably was because Curry actually like missed time and got injured. Game five actually was not a blowout, come to think of it. I'm thinking of the series afterward, or the series last
year.
Game five,
they took control late, but it was very, very late. And I think turned the ball over on the last play, if memory serves. But longtime listeners will remember that I actually, when the Dunked On podcast started, which was in April, I was still on the fence on who the MVP was. I didn't really turn until the very end of the season with Curry. And Harden, I mentioned this before, his counting stats were better, but he played more minutes and he did provide value in those minutes. I'm not discounting that, but it was based on that. And like, Curry had better offensive numbers in terms of PER and true shooting. He also had a higher assist. He also had a higher assist percentage and a lower turnover rate. So like, you have a lot of those components, and both of them were not great defensively.
Yeah. And he was on the number two offense, and Harden was on, you know, the number like 12 offense that year. Houston actually was much more of a defensive team that year than people remember. And as for this year, I mean, stats wise, the stats that we care about, I think, do matter, but I don't give a shit about Russ averaging a triple double. That's not why he was my MVP. In fact, the biggest reason that I had him as the MVP, if you're going to say, and to be clear, of course, all four of those guys at the top are very close to me. The biggest reason I am as the MVP is his clutch performance has been unbelievable. You know, I mean, that if you're really talking about value added that helps you win games, now that may not be sustainable. That may not indicate that he inherently is a better player than James Harden, but he's performed better in the clutch, and the Thunder have performed better in the clutch relative to where they've been as a team this season. And so That's been a big part of it for me. Houston actually is kind of disappointed in the clutch this year, and their late game offense has been a problem.
And it's particularly shocking that Oklahoma City has been that good in that way, because their limitations would make you think that they could actually really struggle in the clutch, and they haven't.
Here's a quick hitter. Vince 05051. Would cutting the length of the regular season cost the league money? Nobody seems to know the answer to that. As far as I can tell, it has not been studied. It certainly should be studied. And I think that it very well could make them money. I mean, by making the product scarcer and making people want to pay more and having the television rating go up, but no one knows the answer.
This is my new white whale. I want to try to find somebody, and it's not me, because I need to find somebody who has access to more data and who is smarter on these sorts of things than I am, because I think that you could shorten the season even by 20 games without losing anything on the national television contract. So then it really becomes how much
that would increase the value of the national television contract.
It's already signed, so I'm going to even argue in the narrow term that it's
I'm not talking about the money that comes into the league. I guess the question was, would it cost the league money? But in terms of just the pure value of it, like to the broadcast partners, right, I think it would be worth more.
Yeah, right, it would be. And so, but you're losing, presumably, in that if you're kind of making that sort of a shift, you're losing money in terms of local TV revenue and naturally gate revenue and everything that comes from that. So you're going to have a portion that is lost in that part of it, but not necessarily a ton. And then also remember that half of the loss in BRI, whatever it is, if it's big or it's small, goes to the players, because the players, you know, there's basically a split of BRI. And I think that actually is the biggest reason why it hasn't happened, is that neither side has too much of an incentive. But if either side starts moving, saying that's a sacrifice we're willing to make, I'm hopeful that it could eventually happen.
K Myers 123. Nate, I recently reread your pre-draft write-up on Marcus Smart from 2014, and I had him as number 3 overall that year. You were so high on his athleticism and ability to finish, calling it elite. Why do you think he struggled so much at this? Well, the reason is that I was wrong. he got to the rim and he finished pretty well at Oklahoma State, but he doesn't have a ton of explosion off of 1 foot. And since that time, I've become more of a believer. This is something that David Locke turned me on to. And I've even talked to a coach in the D-League who says, hey, we charted our players' finishes, and when they go off of 1 foot, they're much more efficient than off of 2. And he's much more explosive off of 2 than off of 1. I watched a lot of him in the U19s the year before he was drafted, and he looked very athletic in that setting, but maybe that was just, again, like he had a lot of like plays where he'd come in for tip dunks off of 2 feet that maybe are not as useful with the ball in his hand. And then also I think you could point to some of the injuries that he's had. He's had severe ankle injuries 2 years in a row before this one, so maybe he's just not quite as good as he was, but I think that's just one that I got to own that I got wrong.
Question from varying_efforts. I think the question was just 2013 LeBron versus 2016 Curry better player. Like, I guess that there isn't a question mark in that, but that does count as a question. And for me, you look at it kind of, you separate out offense and defense, and offensively, I think they're close. Curry last year had one of the best offensive seasons that we've ever seen. It was just spectacular. And really, I would actually say it's fair to use the phrase game-breaking, just in terms of his ability to shoot off the dribble and pull up from long range, from insanely long range. Like, that was legitimately special. LeBron in 2013 was amazing offensively, but not quite at that, you know, like we're talking like cream of the crop standards here. But why I would take 2013 LeBron by a decent margin, not by a ton, is the defensive end. LeBron, beyond being a tank, was able to switch on to smaller guys. He was still at that phase in his career where he could do that. He was disruptive even as kind of a help defender, rim protector player, sort of like how he was in the 2016 finals, but he was more athletic in 2013. So I would take LeBron, especially if I were building teams in the abstract. But, you know, I don't want to say, oh, but it was a close call. I don't think it was a close call for me.
Well, Curry was better in the regular season. I think that was pretty clear. He had, and that LeBron regular season was great too. I mean, we're talking about 2013 Heat, 2016 Warriors were maybe the two best clutch teams ever in the regular season. And then even if you look too at their playoff performance, until of course that game 7, the Warriors were unbelievable in the clutch in the playoffs until that game 7, and the Heat of course had some great clutch performances as well in game 6 and game 7 of that final series. And the biggest reason I would say is that Steph Curry got hurt and LeBron James never, ever, ever gets hurt. And I would have loved to have seen, if Curry didn't get hurt, what he could have done in the playoffs last year. And then also, I think you can also point to the fact that Curry has had a significant drop off this year. You can also point to the fact that even though he won the MVP in 2015, he wasn't near that 2016 level. And so if you wanted to just say, hey, we're going to take you 2016 Curry or 2013 LeBron, and we're going to have you play a whole nother season right now, you can say that Curry's shooting just was not as sustainable as what LeBron was doing, because he was in the midst of, you know, maybe the second greatest run that any player has ever had, and that was really the peak of his powers. Maybe you could look back at 2012 or 09 also as being there, but with his shooting that year especially, 13 is a perfectly fine LeBron season to pick as the best. So I would pick LeBron if Steph Curry hadn't gotten hurt. Maybe I would be thinking about it differently. I do think that if you just look at what they did that regular season, that Curry was better than LeBron in that regular season, but there are a lot of other components than just simply, you know, what their actual performance was, if you wanted to just say how good of a player he was. Sometimes there's a little bit of a difference between those two things.
From Ben Quadinaris.
Wait, hold on. We need to make some more money here.
We can do that.
From SeatGeek, who will actually, and SeatGeek can save you money on tickets and concerts, really any event that has tickets. Frankly, SeatGeek is the way to go for two reasons. Number one, they save you time. They rank every ticket based on value, and they combine together ticket buying sites, so you don't have to go to a bunch of different sites, and you don't have to look at every ticket in a section and try and figure out, okay, you know, this one is four rows ahead of this one, but it costs $10 less. Like, which one do I really want? SeatGeek incorporates all of that into their algorithms, algorithms that I know Danny has been impressed by as a former ticket industry worker. Worker sounds like really so.
You could say ticket broker. Like, that's what I was.
Ah, okay. Former ticket broker. That's worker is like, you know, is this like Russia in 1917? I'd like to think of you as having a little better working conditions than that. But anyway, SeatGeek will save you a bunch of time because those algorithms will tell you where the best deal is. And so now you're only going to one app that saves you time. You can look at what tickets are the best deal for where they are. You click on that ticket and you're done in 2 minutes instead of having to spend 20 minutes trying to find some tickets. So it makes everything much easier. And of course, it wouldn't be a Dunked On ad if you didn't get a discount. $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase via rebate if you enter that CatSpace code. So enter the CatSpace code. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first purchase. That's the free SeatGeek app, promo code CapSpace. Okay, so where were you going to go now, Danny?
Ben Quadinaros. Hopefully I got it better that time. How dumb is it on a scale of 1 to 10 that Fred Hoiberg has now decided to play campaign Michael Carter-Williams and Rajon Rondo over Jerry and Grant every game?
I don't know, four, if only because I think Grant's progress this year has been overstated. He's shooting 36% on threes this year, which is certainly an improvement, and none of these other guys can shoot, but he's also, that's on 113 attempts. You know, if he had missed four more of those attempts, we wouldn't be talking about him being a quality option. His volume is still very low on those shots, and you know, it's not like he has some great assist percentage or he's getting to the rim all the time and creating for others. His defense is fine, but it's not amazing. He'll get some steals every once in a while, but he's not just like locking people down. And he's 24, so I'm not going to say that even though he's a second year player, he has some great amount of development. I would also imagine that Hoiberg has been gently asked to play Cameron Payne, but he's missed the last few games with a foot injury, so we'll see whether he comes back into it now. Carter Williams, he is not going to be a part of their plans, probably as a restricted free agent going forward. Payne might be. So, and they still want to, now that they traded for Payne, they want to see what they have in him. They had to at least give him a shot, and, you know, five games or so, and maybe that shot will have ended now, especially with this foot soreness, because he's been so bad. But there are plenty of reasons for not playing Grant over this period. I will admit that they don't make a ton of sense, but it's not like Grant is some like future stud, in my opinion. So that's why I'd say four.
And up until, and maybe even through now, they've been trying to make the playoffs, and they're trying to kind of accomplish a couple different things at one point. And they also might have a better sense of Grant, considering they've had him the whole year and he's been healthier than Carter Williams has. And then Rondo, you know, if they're trying to win, Rondo arguably makes the most sense. So I understand at least parts of it.
Cly Maximus, should the Pistons blow it up? Third highest payroll in the league, currently sitting at ninth in the East. they also are going to have to pay Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, which he didn't say. But he said they could be perceived as a low ceiling moving forward. What do you think?
I don't know what blowing it up for them means. They're, you know, they have a bunch of guys on kind of mid contracts, you know, like in the kind of in the teen range, that Tobias Harris, Reggie Jackson, John Lure, and then they have, of course, the max contract from Drummond and probably max contract KCP. So they're not really going to be a cap team, like at least in a significant way anyway. I don't think they're going to pull, you know, I don't think the what is preventing them from getting Gordon Hayward is not having max space. It's, you know, I don't think Gordon Hayward's going to go there anyway. So I don't think that blowing it up for them really makes much sense. You listen on all of their guys. They have nobody at this point who I would say you
Stan has said exactly that, basically.
Yeah. So you listen on everybody. If another team overvalues your asset, by all means. And if another team undervalues their own asset, you do that. But that's not blowing it up.
Yeah, it'd be one thing if all these guys were 27 or 28. But yeah, they stagnated a little bit this year, for sure. But Reggie, KCP, they still have Stanley Johnson, who's got a little bit of upside. Drummond, we've talked about how we don't think he has as much upside just due to the nature of his game on the 15 and 60. But nonetheless, he's a little younger. He should just get better defensively, at least. So I think that this year has been a bit of a step back, but they could get back on the path to where if everything breaks right, they could win 50 games for 2 or 3 years. And, you know, is that really worth that much before then those guys start to get old again? Maybe not, but, you know, would you rather just be terrible for the next 3 years instead and just like try to get a bunch of draft picks? You know, that's not what Sam McGinney signed on for. And for where they were when he came in, you know, it's not like they had a ton of upside there either. They just had like, you know, a bunch of number 8 picks on their team. So they're in a rut. But at least they're young enough to where they can steadily improve over the next 2, 3, 4 years. No, I wouldn't blow it up. I don't really see what the alternative is. It may not be satisfying to say, hey, how is this team ever going to win a championship? They're probably not, but you know, that's how 20 of these teams in the league probably feel at times.
At least 20. From the Gourmet 9, why are you guys so low on young players' potential to get better and improve? A lot of NBA players become starters or occasionally make huge leaps to be stars by in their mid to late 20s. Maybe they're just predictions and I'm taking them too seriously as statements. Maybe.
There are plenty of guys that I'm not low on as far as their ability to improve, but you have to have a reason to believe that they will improve other than just simply, you know, it's his first or second year in the league, right? I mean, predicting improvement is one of the hardest things to do. I mean, Jimmy Butler was 24 and a role player, and now he's a top 15 player. It's not something that you can do that well, but you have to look at what the history has largely been of players who have been similar. And if a guy is playing, I mean, usually future performance is in general, and there are obviously very many exceptions to this, a function of what is the guy's age and how well is he playing right now? And then you can break that down into, you know, what is his potential physically and how is what he's doing right now? Is he showing flashes, all of that stuff? But generally, that's kind of how you do it. And if you're Chris Dunn and you're playing horrendously and you're already 23, I'm sorry, it's hard to think that he is going to make a leap. It's happened before. You can't write it off completely, but the overwhelming history shows that players like that who are older and don't play well aren't going to improve.
The exceptions to the rule.
I mean, I shouldn't say aren't going to improve, but won't become, you know, star players, which he was drafted at number 5 in theory to be, or even, you know, very high quality starters.
The exceptions to the rule in this case are far more memorable because A, they're becoming good players, and B, they're just, you know, like,
that's
you
a great
think about
point,
them.
Right?
Like think Isaiah of all Thomas. Dudes. Isaiah Thomas, yeah. Kyle Lowry, those type of players don't have very much. And a lot of them, it's because they figure out how to shoot. Like there is this resounding parallel with all of them. And also there is like a consideration that I had this with people got really mad at me because I said I would like right now I would decline Henry Ellenson's third year option.
Yeah, I didn't agree with you on that, by the way. Right. Dan Feldman for highlighting that.
Let me give a little context on it. With all of that, what I mean by that is not I would do that right now. Of course not. That's silly. But what I'm saying is I would be leaning in that direction if after you get all of the available information between now and October that he goes in, that it goes in that direction. I could go into more with roster spots, but I don't think people care. But the idea here is that there are a lot of players who get into those circumstances and don't succeed. And we don't focus on it as much. You know, they kind of fall by the wayside. The Gerald Greens of the world or any, you could go in a million different directions.
No one's going to remember Tyler Tyler Ennis, because he'll probably be out of the league after this year, as a guy who looked terrible his rookie year and then just never improved and was out of the league. But, you know,
or Nick Stauskas.
There are plenty of those, or Ben McLemore. There are plenty of examples of guys who just weren't good as rookies and were a certain age. And then just, I'm not going to completely give up on Stauskas and McLemore as NBA players even still. But there are a lot of these guys who, you don't remember all these lists of guys because they're completely nondescript. You remember Jimmy Butler.
And the last point I want to make, this is where I was going before I took myself on the Henry Ellenson tangent, is that whenever we're making statements like this, it is a likelihood proposition, not a certainty thing. So no matter what, there is always the possibility of things changing outside of our control, whether in the positive or negative way. You know, maybe a player has some sort of off the court thing that becomes a big problem, or they have a way better like work ethic and they fix a flaw that we thought was intractable. What a statement like Chris Dunn, like it isn't going to work with Chris Dunn, is saying is that maybe it's an 85% chance or a 75% chance. You're always reserving the possibility. We can't see into the future. And I think what a lot of people do is there's this issue with probability. This came up in other contexts, which I don't need to get into, of extreme likelihood being certainty. And those are absolutely not the same thing.
Yeah. Well, no, what you're talking about is the election and how Nate Silver said there was a 30% chance that Trump was going to win. And everyone's like, oh, you can't trust any these projections because he said Hillary had a 70% chance of winning and then Trump won. But, you know, 70% is 70%, right? Like, I mean, if you're shooting a free throw, if I say you have a 70% chance of shooting this free throw and then you miss it, that doesn't mean that like the data that says you're a 70% free throw shooter was wrong because you missed one free throw. But anyway, that's I've gotten a few, mostly on Twitter, when I'll like cite to like the 538 numbers or something like that. And they'll be like, oh, we all know that these projections are worthless. Like, no, they're not worthless. It's just, it gives you, in fact, I kind of like them because they do have validity. And then when something counteracts them, you can say that, hey, yeah, this was actually pretty unlikely. Like, look at that. That was pretty cool. Sometimes in sports rather than politics, when, you know, the consequences don't really matter on a society, you can maybe take a little more lighthearted view of things. Let's move on here. One thing that we actually did too is we took some questions towards the end as well, because I heard that like people were just getting downvoted for no reason. But I scrolled up from the bottom just to see if there are any good ones that we liked. Let's see here. This is from Prowl. Possible destinations for Patty Mills this offseason and at what price?
If he wants to be a starter, there will probably be a few options on the table. We don't know exactly who's going to be making the decisions in Orlando, but if it's not Rob Hennigan, I could see them having Mills where he's a good player and can be part of the answer, but is not definitively over Elfrid Payton. You know, like you can kind of strike that balance a little bit. And really, whoever misses out on Drew Holiday and a couple of the other best teams, that could be New York, could be Sacramento, you know, whatever kind of team is left out there when the music stops. But where I think he's going to end up is San Antonio.
I'm thinking Jeremy Lin type of money for him. You'll recall that Lin 3 for 36 with a player option on that third year. Mills is 28. I think that's about right for him. He hasn't made that much money in his career. I think that he's good in San Antonio because he's got Manu Ginobili, who could be retired by that point, and Kawhi Leonard next to him. I think he actually, on a team like the Magic, not to say that they won't sign him, but his skills would be wasted there because he's not really a pick and roll creator. That's what the Magic need. I think the Bulls, next to Jimmy Butler, he could be good. They desperately need someone who can just make a shot as a point guard. The Pacers, if they were to lose Jeff Teague. The Wolves, he might make a pretty nice platoon with Rubio if they can't get the upgrades on the wing. The Heat, the Knicks, the Pelicans, if they lose Drew Holiday. The Sixers, he'd be an excellent fit, and he's familiar with Brett Brown from his Australian national team days. The Sacramento Kings, if they lose Darren Collison in free agency. So he's a good fit in a lot of places. This is a high-end backup, low-end type of starter. This next one is from Why Not. It's YNAUT. I prefer to pronounce it, though, like Arnold Schwarzenegger from those old Schwarzenegger soundboards. Why Not? So this is the question. To the best of your knowledge, has anyone broken down jump shot attempts by the direction, speed type of the shooter's movement immediately prior to shooting? And you could certainly do this with SportView. Nobody has access to that publicly, but I don't really think that getting this answer is going to help much. We know that it's harder to shoot when you're moving sideways or, when you're really on the move or something. Everyone would tell you that. I don't really think there's anything to really be confirmed there. I think that defender distance can be a pretty good proxy for how hard the shot is. So, yeah, I don't really think that it's worth the time to spend researching this, put it on stuff that we really don't understand. Because answering this question would be interesting, but I don't think it adds to our understanding that much, because I'm 99.9% sure we already know the answer to this.
A question from Me Gib, which actually starts with a statement. Your coach of the year discussion seems to be based on or around teams that exceeded expectations, and they brought up Brad Stevens. Does the fact that his team greatly exceeded expectations in the previous 2 years hurt his coach of the year candidacy? I want to break this down into a couple different things. One, I will classify it in terms of how I think of our discussions. I think that when we're talking about who we think will win coach of the year, we go on that direction because that's how the actual voting goes. Because Sam Mitchell and coaches of that ilk that win are generally, you know, and Terry Stotts didn't win, but he was close because they really exceeded expectations. Kerr won last year because the Warriors won 73 games. That's the sort of thing that happens. However, you more so than me, but we're both in the same camp that if we had votes, that is not how we would vote for coach of the year, because that is very different from who did the best coaching job. And Stevens is an interesting example here, because I don't think that the Celtics have particularly exceeded expectations this year. They did in prior years. That's why he was a candidate for coach of the year, but didn't win because other people did slightly better jobs.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that for Brad Stevens, his performance is already priced in because they've exceeded expectations in past years. So now their expectations are higher because of his good coaching in past years. So it's hard for him to again exceed expectations when the expectation of good coaching was already priced in for them this year. But yeah, I mean, I think Popovich would be my pick for coach of the year. I think he's the best coach. I think in most circumstances, you know, probably 80% of your evaluation for coach of the year should just be who you think the best coach is. I think he and Kerr are the two best coaches in the league, and then there's a very good group right behind them as well. But yeah, my pick for this year would be Greg Popovich, and so I'm basically doing the exact opposite of what you're saying we're doing here.
An interesting question from StoopKid74: would you be in favor of removing the lottery and replacing it with a single elimination tournament non-playoff teams where the winners is awarded the number one pick, number two gets number two? Would that reduce regular season tanking? So I actually have written about this in the past, back in 2011. I actually found this piece because there was a discussion about Kevin Arnovitz had written a piece that somebody referenced in terms of ways of eliminating it. The biggest problem with it is a structural one, because you're asking players who are on the team to risk injury for probably a very limited financial return to get players that will potentially bump them in the rotation. It's a major problem.
Does Eric Bledsoe want to, I mean, maybe he would because he just wants to get out of Phoenix, but would Eric Bledsoe, in theory, or maybe a player with less talent who could be like pushed to the bench, you know, would Ricky Rubio want to like help the Wolves win this tournament so that they can then draft Markelle Fultz and replace him? Like,
yeah, you know, especially a player who's going to be a free agent like after the next year, or a player who's going to get squeezed out in that sort of a way. And I think you and I both have different ideas on how to resolve this. Mine, and if you want to read the full thing, it's on the Sporting News. I wrote it, I think it was a year and a half ago, about what I would do. It's similar to what Amin Al-Hassan has proposed, which is you give teams blocks of money based on kind of the idea of draft slots, and then based on finish, and then the players just basically go into a rookie pool, and the players can get contracts based on that amount, and you could either trade or combine those amounts together, so that if a player wants to sacrifice money to go to a better situation, they can. And that actually has gotten more complicated now with the idea of the Supermax, because now you might actually want to go, now the sacrifice is different to go to a major market early, because those teams have a unique ability to re-sign players later on.
Yeah, I think all that's too complicated. My only change to the current system would be just fix it so if you win less than 15 games, you can't get the number one pick in the lottery. That would eliminate just totally egregious season-long tanking. But I still think that the evil of a team having no hope is much greater than a team not really trying that hard for the last 20 games, which, as we've discussed, is really something that it's rational to do anyway, as we saw it with baseball teams who didn't value the draft up until a few years ago. For example, trying to develop young players, even football teams will, you know, bring in a young quarterback for the last couple of games or so to try and evaluate. So you're still going to see this type of behavior, maybe not quite as extreme as what we've seen from the Lakers. But to me, the idea of a team having just no hope over like a really long period, which could very easily happen with this tournament idea or just being a terrible situation, guys not wanting to go there, all of that is still a much greater evil for me than this tanking is.
Well, and also with the tournament, what are you rewarding? Are you rewarding teams that are just good enough to not make the playoffs? Like, what's the point? Like, I think about all these things in terms of what behavior are you incentivizing, and it's very unclear to me, other than the entertainment involved in that, who it would benefit. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, you and there's could be a lot of unintended consequences there too.
Oh yeah.
Jammy Jam, I can take this one. Can you talk about Orlando's draft luck? Why does it always seem that the top level talent they've had in the past always wants to leave as soon as possible? Well, remember, Dwight signed an extension, so he didn't leave as soon as possible. No one ever turns down those max extensions.
And then he signed away his ETO.
Yeah, that's right. And then their draft luck, they got the number one pick 2 years in a row in 92 and 93. So hard to complain about that. I mean, they got number two in 2013, and then they got number five these last couple of years and have not necessarily done too well. Or they got four and then they got five, and have not necessarily done too well with that. Then they traded away, obviously, the number 11 pick last year. I don't think that they've had that bad of luck. And the reason that Shaq left was that they probably could have offered him more money, and they signed a dumb contract with him that he could get out of that early. And then Dwight Howard, the team was doing okay for a while, and then they clearly were on the downswing. They didn't have a way to get better due to some of the contracts that had been signed. They had Rashard Lewis and then Gilbert Arenas on the books. That team had kind of had their shot. I understand why he wanted out of there at that time. It made sense to me. I think that like people would be happy to stay in Orlando if it were a winning situation. And I mean, remember, for like, as you can't say Orlando has no appeal. They got like Tracy McGrady and Grant Hill to go there as free agents.
And almost got Tim Duncan, almost. Yeah. And I think with Shaq, you also have to remember that he left for almost a perfect situation. It was the Lakers, who had interesting young talent, and it's the Lakers back when they still had all of that, or Showtime wasn't that long ago at that point, and they offered him a ton of money. Like, that's a circumstance that if it existed in today's world, a young player of his quality would do anyway. Like, that was bad luck just because they had the wrong player at the wrong time.
Barncore, early in the season, a lot of people seemed to count Buddy Hield out. Now he's playing well in Sacramento, which we talked about. And then they said, why is no one talking about him? And he lists off their stats. I'm like, well, actually, the last 15 and 60 we did about Sacramento, we listed off those exact same stats for Buddy Hield and talked about him extensively. Also recall that, I probably did like a 10-minute breakdown on how Buddy Hield was playing in New Orleans. So we've looked at him pretty extensively. He says, is it inconceivable to see him becoming a starter level 3-and-D guy on a good team? I don't think he's ever going to get there defensively. This guy says his athleticism is better than people give him credit for. I disagree. I don't think he has, especially his leaping ability is pretty low, definitely below average for an NBA shooting guard. So, I mean, I could see him being an acceptable defensive player. He is going to work hard. And maybe he could still turn into a lower end starter when you consider he can hit threes, stand still at a very high rate, and can also, I think will defend adequately, but he's also a one position defender. That's important to remember too. So I think he could be, it's not going to be like a horrible player. I don't think he's going to just wash out of the league. It's just, he was drafted number six. People had higher hopes for him. I don't think he's going to achieve them.
One other thing I want to mention, I'll echo all of that, is that his free throw attempt rate has more than doubled since he's been on the Kings. And if it can stay closer to where he is now, that's great. But I think that doubling it, I think he's at like 0.167 right now. I think that if that starts to drop, then that also hurts his value as well.
Very quick one here. Who Gussel Sprott asks, who makes the playoffs sooner, Wolves or Pels? We'll assume they'll both miss it this year.
Wolves. Either way, it's the Wolves.
Yeah, you just don't have the faith in New Orleans getting it together, even with Davis and Cousins next year.
They don't have, so assuming Drew comes back, which is a big question.
That's a question. If they lose him, they're really burned.
Right. So they have that downside possibility, and also they can't add too much outside of it. I mean, you could see players like Solomon Hill do better than they did this year. I would be hopeful of that, but they don't have a lot of means for improvement, especially because they presumably won't have their own draft pick. And so the Wolves do, because they have cap space, they have a coach/GM who wants to spend their money and get better. So all of that runs together. From Thomas_
Oh, wait, hold on. One other thing we have to say on the Pels, which is on my podcast with Justin Ferrier, we posited the scenario that what if the Pels were to actually re-sign Omri Caspi, would they still have his bird rights? Because the way that rule is written is, it can be one or more contracts. But I thought that since he was traded and then they were going to release him and then re-sign him, that might impact that. I talked to Larry Kuhn about that. He confirmed that actually they would in fact have his bird rights if they were to re-sign him, Caspi. And so I think that they should definitely try and do that. He has in fact been working out at the Pels facility, and maybe maybe even offer, because he's going to have some chances to go to playoff teams, maybe even offer him their room exception, which they still have some of. That would be probably about, you know, $1.5 million or so for just the, you know, these few games, pay him a little bit more, and he only was making three this whole year, and then just as an enticement to get him to sign on, and then they would still have his bird rights. And in fact, if they signed him on to just a minimum rest of season contract, then they'd have his bird rights, and his cap hold would only be the minimum. So that actually would be even better than what his cap hold would have been before. You know, it's actually, that would be a great potential for abuse, Danny. Although the only problem is then that people could just claim the guy off of waivers if they wanted to do that. That's the risk. So I was thinking like, oh, you have a guy who's making $20 million, and then, oh, how about this? How about we just release him and we'll re-sign him to a minimum. We'll still have his bird rights. And then, you know, his cap hole to be the minimum. But it could happen with
like, I don't know, this isn't a good example because he didn't want to stay there, but like Joe Johnson on the Nets, or a player, there are players who have contracts.
Or you could just do it at the end of the year if the guy's caps, you know, was making so much that no other team could actually claim him off of waivers. You know, nobody could claim him. I'm sure the league would probably crack down on that because that would be like pretty clear circumvention, but that would be a really interesting loophole. And that's why, frankly, I think that that should not be the rule, that like, if you get traded with your bird rights, if you then get released, you shouldn't be able to
if you get released and unclaimed, then you lose all bird rights. I mean, that's just the way it should work.
Yeah, and not claimed, right? Yeah, I think that's I mean they also want to reward guys who, you know, let's say you sign a 10-day and then your contract ends, and you know, maybe you're kind of scrapping and clawing at the beginning of the contract.
Well, sure,
I would say
at the beginning, maybe
if you get released in the last year of your contract, that might be the way to do that, that you lose your bird rights with that team if you get released in the last year of your contract.
God, now I'm going to think about all these guys next year that theoretically, like, who could they waive and then lower it? Like a guy who, I'm going to figure out somebody for this. Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, I don't think this will ever happen, and it would be pretty risky and kind of weird, and the league would probably just outlaw it anyway. All right, let's get two more here, and then we can, I thought this one was good. Thomas Leggett, which NBA team do you think would win a tournament between players 11 through 15 in each squad?
My first answer was Miami, because those guys play really hard, and unlike a lot of other teams, they don't really have stashed guys down there. It's more like Okoro Whites, who've played well in the D League and have actually, you know, are kind of battle tested that way. It's not like the Raptors, who have some good players but would also have Bruno out there. So I think you kind of look in that direction. There are a few other teams that have some very interesting cases, but I think the Heat would actually win it.
I would go with the Spurs, because they just always have such good success, even when they're resting guys and bring those guys in. I think when you have less talent overall, coaching then becomes even more important, and the Spurs have had good success. The Jazz and Nuggets would also come to mind, just because they are just so deep with quality players.
I think the Nuggets would be the best team, personally. I think they would have the most talent. I just don't think they would win.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, you might go with the Jazz too. I mean, they've got a lot of guys who, you know, could be 11-15 when fully healthy, you know. I mean, they would have either Shelvin Mack at point guard. I mean, they could bring in Alec Burks, probably wouldn't even necessarily be in their top 10. Trey Lyles, you know, Jeff Withey. Like, it wouldn't be bad. But I think it would be the Spurs, just due to, I mean, because we know that the Spurs, even when they're playing their lower end guys, have been really good before. All right, where do you want to go next here?
Well, I think this is probably going to be the last one, right? D. Moussens. Do you think that Paul George's aversion to playing the four has held him back from reaching the next tier of star players, and which other players in the league might this type of thing affect going forward? One, Paul George is aversion to playing the four. He's best defending threes, so his aversion to playing the fours doesn't really make much sense, because that's not a good use of his value. You want to have another wing near him, or somebody who can kind of, you know, be that hybrid who can shoot threes and also defend fours. So I don't blame him for that, because it's not a good use of him.
Well, it is a good use of him offensively.
Sure.
But the problem is they don't have any other wings with any kind of size. They tried, I mean, and last year when they did it, Paul George was still defending threes. When we talked about this move initially, and there was this controversy over it, I mean, he had to defend Anthony Davis like a little bit in the preseason, but it was clear that he was mostly going to be defending threes. As you said, that's the best use for him. They just have never had another 3-and-D guy. Bringing in Thad Young was kind of a step in that direction, but Young not quite as good of a shooter. And also remember when he tried to come back play the four, he had just, you know, had that horrific broken leg a year earlier, and he was still experiencing soreness in that leg even throughout that season. So the idea of having to take that physical pounding, it did not really appeal to him. But I think the bigger problem is that if they really had someone who is big enough to guard power forwards and could still shoot and kind of be a wing, that he would be fine playing the four on offense. Nobody minds doing that. Everyone loves playing the four on offense. It's the defense that sucks. And there's really no reason for him to play the four on defense, as you said. We do have actually one more here that I wrote out an answer to, so maybe we should hit that one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I just missed it on the sheet. So from Tigris Altasia? So it's a hard one for me to pronounce. How important is game time for the development of young players? What's the limit for the development that can be achieved during practice, film study, etc.?
So I think it was Kevin Pelton, and forgive me this because I'm going from memory here, if this is not an entirely accurate summary, but once you adjust for the fact that better players are just going to play more, there's no evidence that playing in NBA games actually helps with development in the first couple of years, which certainly would be counterintuitive. But in some ways, when you first come in, you're trying not to screw up. You're playing as like an ultra role player. I do think that playing in the D League helps, but really, I mean, just being in the NBA, the amount of work that guys do, whether it's film, whether it's getting stronger, whether it's just, you know, 2 hours of shooting a day, I mean, or you know, whatever it is, going to practices, playing in practice, all that stuff I think really helps. In fact, I would much rather have a player, even without the D League, sitting on the bench in the NBA and just learning how to be a professional, learning from NBA players, learning from NBA coaches, learning how to just be a man, learning how to develop the skills that you're going to need to be successful in the NBA, as opposed to, like we talked about earlier, right? Like if you're just some senior who scores 17 points a game in college in ways that you're never going to be asked to do in the NBA because you don't have that type of talent or athleticism to be a scorer in the NBA, like that doesn't help you. I mean, you know, it's still basketball, you're going to get better at shooting and stuff, but in general, staying in college for longer gets you to be a better college player, and being in the NBA, even if you're not necessarily playing, helps you become a better NBA player.
Yeah, I have no opposition really to any of that. It's an interesting kind of question also because there's so many different things that you would want to control for if you were going to compare it within the NBA. And I think that you're also like the support staff is an important part of this. Like not only the accountability, but that you have these people who it's their job to make sure that you're the best at doing your job, and not just temporarily, but permanently, because that team is invested in you. And that's, you know, like you hear players talk about that. And also the support staff is an important part, but also I think about like the way that Steve Nash influenced the nutrition of basically every guy who ever played with him. Once he reached that kind of level, Jared Dudley talks about this a lot. Those individuals exist in the NBA and are far less prevalent in college, though college teams have strength coaches and all that sort of stuff as well. In the pros, it's generally the best of the best, and you have the institutional knowledge.
Yeah, and frankly, like a lot of college coaches are clowns. Yeah, I mean, they're just, and they're not concerned about getting you ready for the NBA. The example that I think I can cite to, this is an older one, is Jermaine O'Neal. Jermaine O'Neal basically sat on the bench for like 3 years in Portland. I think he was drafted in like 97. And even by like the 2000 Western Conference Finals, wasn't really playing. And then he got traded to Indiana and was like basically immediately good. I think he had 1 year where he maybe averaged like 12-7. And then he was an all-star for like 4 years immediately after that, helped them win 60 games. So I think it's definitely quite possible to learn when you're on an NBA bench. Certainly can't hurt to get development time for sure. Can't hurt to go to the D League, especially if you have a player like, you know, I think even someone like Jaylen Brown, the big team has been using him and he's been helping them win games, so this wouldn't happen. But a player like Jaylen Brown, I think, could benefit from going to the D League just from having the ball in his hands a little bit more and kind of helping to develop as a scorer. But, you know, there's also Summer League for doing that too. You know, I think there's still plenty of development that's possible. So, I'm not sure that there is necessarily a ceiling. I mean, unless you just account for the fact that, hey, if this guy was really that good, you know, he'd be playing right now. He'd force his way. Even someone like Kobe Bryant on a loaded Lakers team, you know, he at least played some his rookie year, and then I think he even made the all-star team or something in his second year. So if you're really going to be like an all-time great, you're going to be playing even, you know, if you're right out of college, your first year at age 19. But yeah,
they can't all sit behind AC Law.
All right, that'll do it for today. Thanks so much to our sponsors, SeatGeek. Use that CatSpace code to get $20 back from your first SeatGeek purchase. And MeUndies, MeUndies.com/CatSpace. Get 20% off your first purchase for the most comfortable pair of underwear that you have ever owned. Talk to y'all next time.